Alright, good day. Today is October 11th, 2008. My name is Justin Lyons, and I'm a cadet at the California Maritime Academy. Today I will be interviewing Captain David Sears, born on July 28th, 1937, for the California Maritime Academy Library Oral History Project. The interview is being recorded by Dominique Pongan, another cadet at the Maritime Academy. Alright. Captain Sears, to start this out, when and where did you graduate from?
I graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1959.
Now, while you were there, what did you major in?
Well, it was at that time, it was one curriculum fits all, very similar to what it was here at CMA for many years. Mm-hmm. So everybody took the same course, and it was basically naval engineering.
Okay, so
it was a lot of Navy science type courses, but then there was you had to have certain minimum math and engineering courses.
Okay,
primarily to meet Admiral Rickover's requirements.
He
spelled out this is every graduate's got to be able to qualify for a nuclear power program.
Yeah, I've heard about him.
Yeah.
All right. Now, how long were you in the Navy afterwards?
I was in the Navy 20 years after I graduated.
And what was it that you did while you were in the Navy?
Well, I spent about 3 years on a destroyer out of Norfolk, and then I went to submarine training and nuclear power training, and then I spent the next few years was on two new construction fast attack submarines. We built them down in Mississippi, and then I was on two fleet ballistic missile submarines, and thrown in there was my one and only shore duty assignment. I had one shore duty assignment in 20 years, and that was instructor at the submarine school in New London for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then after I spent 4 years in command of a submarine, I went and spent the last year in the Navy down at Sinkland Fleet in Norfolk. It's a joint staff.
Oh, wow. Now, did you prefer being out on the ships and, you know, working like that over teaching?
No, that's one of the reasons I came to CMA is because I really enjoyed my teaching time at submarine school. Mm-hmm. Even though it was pretty short stint. But at the time, the Navy was building submarines like crazy, and they couldn't get enough qualified officers to man them. Mm-hmm. In other words, the pipeline feeding people in couldn't keep up with the demand. So in the Navy, you're supposed to, after your first sea tour, you're supposed to alternate sea and shore, with about 2 years, 2.5 to 3 years on each assignment. And in my case, you know, they just take me from one submarine and stick me on another one.
Yeah.
And so out of necessity, I had a lot of sea time and very little shore time. Mm-hmm. But it was fun.
Yeah.
Now,
from all that sea time, is that how you were able to get your licenses and accelerate them?
Well, it was, the Coast Guard at the time didn't know how to handle a submariner. So they didn't have any problem qualifying me to sit for engineering license. Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't a problem. The problem was the deck license. And they said, well, because you're a Naval Academy graduate, of course, that was 20 years before, they said, you're qualified to sit for a third mate's. So I said, well, you got to have a deck license for this job that I've got out in California. So I says, I'll take it. So I sat for my third mate's license in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And moved out here and started to work. And then I started working with the Coast Guard and convinced them that, you know, a submarine was really a very deep trap surface ship.
Mm-hmm.
You had to worry about the bottom all the time. So they went ahead and authorized me to sit for my master's license. So I went from a a third mate's license right to a master's license.
Wow.
But it took a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, understandably. Now, how long did you end up teaching at the Maritime Academy?
25 years.
25 years.
Yeah.
Now, during that time, what positions did you hold?
Well, let's see. I started out, teaching basically marlin spike seamanship and advanced seamanship and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to teach an advanced navigation course. And then John Kiever was the department chair when I first came to work here. And that's an interesting story in and of itself, because I had flown out here and interviewed for the job, and then, like any good job applicant, I would call him once a week to find out what's going on and just be a real pest. And he said, well, there's four applicants, and to be honest with you, you're not our number one choice. And then he said, in reality, you're probably not our number two or our number three choice either. And the thing that concerned them, and rightfully so, was, all of my Navy experience, how would that relate to a school that is basically teaching merchant service issues?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, on submarines, we didn't have a lot of cargo ops, and we didn't have a lot of cargo gear. When we loaded cargo, it was two sailors carrying something down a hatch, and that was cargo ops for us. So, but what turned out happening is the other three applicants turned the job down. So that's how I got the job. I was the longest surviving applicant, I think. But John then, I guess, probably had to be like 82 maybe. He moved up to be captain of the training ship. So he asked me to be the chief mate. So I was the chief mate on the training ship, probably for about 15 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the people out in the boathouse, we had four ABs and a bosun and a carpenter, and that was it. And the bosun and the carpenter and the chief mate, who basically worked full-time on the ship, had to also teach, I think it was two or three, we had to teach at least 12 units of classroom work.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't part of the ship. We were really in the MT department, and the ship work was secondary. Since then, we just sort of recognized that just doesn't work. So we formed the Maritime Operations Department here, I guess, about almost 10 years ago now, sort of try and split them out. And we split up some of the coursework. So some of the courses that used to be MT courses, we put down in the Maritime Ops Department. So like life-saving and small boat ops, tug and barge, those things went to the Maritime Ops Department. Before that, they belonged to us. But the other reason I think I got the job, to be honest with you,
mm-hmm.
is at the time, MARAD had still not given up on the idea of the Savannah. Now, the Savannah was a nuclear-powered demonstration cargo ship that was operated by the Maritime Administration, and they still had aspirations that there would be a lot of nuclear-powered merchant ships.
Okay.
And so what they required of all the state academies and the federal academy is that they taught nuclear propulsion.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't a full-fledged thing, but we had to teach basically some nuclear power things, as well as the basic math, thermodynamics that go along with it. And so I was hired to be the instructor for these courses, if any student ever signed up for one. And interestingly enough, no student ever signed up for one.
Really?
Well, I used to go, Mr. McLemore used to, once in a while, would have a group of students that were way ahead on the curriculum. So he'd sort of take a little side shot and teach nuclear power fundamentals. So he'd have me come in and do maybe 1 or 2 hours of class in it, you know, with him. But that's pretty much, you know, how I got here.
Wow. Now, I'm sorry. Your experience in the Navy, was, you stated before that it was more engineering than deck operations.
Well, yeah, it was, because of the way Admiral Rickover ran his submarines. You know, is that the cap, even the captain and the exec, were intimately involved. I mean, it was, you know, I was the captain and I was reviewing engineering logs, just like when I was chief engineer. You're going through all the logs and all the routine maintenances and stuff. But by the same token, once I stopped being, I was a chief engineer on a new construction ship down in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But once I left that job, most of my time was really spent on either personnel administration or, you know, the operational aspects of the ship.
Okay. Now, what was your favorite position while here at the Academy?
Oh, you mean favorite? Well, I don't know. To be honest with you, I liked the classroom the best.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I enjoyed being chief mate. That was always a lot of fun. But from a just enjoyable, you know, working with students, I think, you know, the cruises where I was second mate was even better than that.
Yeah.
Because chief mate was just a lot of work, and it was always, you know, the second mate, you get to stay in a bridge where it's either air conditioned or heated, you know, instead of being out. I can remember one time, chief mate, we're coming out of Vancouver, and it's about a 4-hour pilot job. I think the only longer pilot job was coming down the River Platte from Buenos Aires going down to Uruguay. Mm-hmm. But coming down from Vancouver, it was winter time. And you got to remember that back and up until, I guess, maybe 15 years ago, we were on a trimester system, which meant that we had 3 terms. Two of the terms were like, I want to say 18-week terms. And then one of the terms was a 12-week term. And the 12-week term was in a winter time. And what we'd do is that January 1st, we'd load up the third class, second class, first class on the train ship. We'd leave the fourth class here all by themselves. And they would have academic work, and we would take the ship out of here.
Oh, wow.
And so, by and large, when the weather got terrible here, our policy was, let's go where it's warm. And so, we typically, you know, would always hit Hawaii, but we would go South Pacific 1 year, South America the next, and sort of back and forth. And then for, you know, recruiting purposes, we'd always try and end the cruise, you know, at some of the more, shall we say, resource-rich places. So San Diego, Long Beach, we'd almost always go up to Astoria. For some reason, we always had a lot of students come from, you know, basically the lower Columbia River, Seattle, and then this 1 year we went up to Vancouver. And so it's freezing cold. And it's foggy. You can't, it's maybe a quarter of a mile visibility. So I spent 4 hours out there on the bow as lookout, freezing my tail off. And the only saving grace was, you know, is that you could always ask for somebody to bring you a cup of coffee. But the problem with that, of course, if somebody brings you a cup of coffee, sooner or later you're going to have to go to the head. You know that the leaving the brow is not going to happen for quite a while.
Yeah.
So that was always fun. But I always really mostly enjoyed just being in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
I found that just the interplay with the students in the classroom was sort of what was interesting and challenging. Mm-hmm. And and you know, the funny thing about it is some of the people that I used to barter back and forth as instructor student, you know, now they're faculty here. But Mr. Sarheim was one of my students, and Mr. Weinstock was one of my students. And I always promised them that I would never open my grade book. And so when I retired, I actually took all my grade books and, you know, from 25 years and shredded them.
Wow.
So.
That took a while?
No, it didn't take that long, but I just, you know, I always used to tease them saying, you know, students would be glad to know what kind of student you were.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the training cruises. What were your main duties while you were on those training cruises?
Well, most of the time, we had sort of not a very effective way of training for the first maybe 15 years I was here.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of bought into the perception that the Coast Guard had and that all the other academies had, is that somehow a student watching the water go by for a day had some intrinsic educational value. In other words, it was sea time was the criteria. So, I mean, if you just sat out there and did nothing, somehow you were a day smarter in all things maritime. And so we basically took the ship to sea, operated it, and so there was, on the watch standing and things like that, there was some good training going on, but the number of students we had, of course, was not that great in those days, but it still amounted to maybe 10 to 12 watches.
Mm-hmm.
In a whole cruise. And so the rest of the, what do you do with the rest of the time? Well, seniors, we had them teaching classes.
Wow. What classes were those?
We'd have them teach rules of rote. And usually what I'd do, because the chief mate at that time was sort of in charge not only the operational aspects of the ship,
mm-hmm.
but shipboard training during cruise. And so what I'd do is I'd pick the student who had the lowest grade in rules of the road back here at school to teach the third class rules of the road. And the reason I found that that worked out pretty good for us was that a senior would not want to be embarrassed by a sophomore on their lack of knowledge of rules of the road. So they'd go into these classes very well prepared. Now, the way it worked is we'd get back from end of cruise in March. We would have for the seniors like a 6-week instructional period,
mm-hmm.
where they had no classes except license prep. And so from 8 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, we had them doing license preparation work. And then at the end of the 6 week, Coast Guard would come up and administer the thirds exams for both the deck and the engine. And we usually had that up in 201-202. And at the time, the whole second floor of the classroom building was one long room. Now it's what, three?
Yes, sir.
Three. But then it was one. And it was filled with, I think we had like 90 drafting tables in there with the little drafting stools. And there was a sink where the drinking fountain is now. There was a sink, the deep sink there, so you could wash your hands so you wouldn't smudge your drawings. And both deck and engineering students took a traditional drafting course. And that was the purpose of the room. Well, that's where we had hold the license exam. And so it was a pretty convenient place to be.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found was that the students that taught Rules of the Road on cruise always got the highest scores on Rules of the Road on license exam. Well, duh. It's because they just spent, 12 weeks learning it in great detail so they could teach it. And so what I found is the student that you always thought might have trouble on Rules of the Road for licensing purposes, they never had a problem. But it was an interesting time, too, because having 100% pass rate was not unusual for both deck and engine.
Mm-hmm.
Engineers typically would run maybe 2 to 8% better pass rate. In other words, the engineers might be 100% and the deckies might be 92%. And that, when I say pass, I mean pass every subject first sitting.
Okay.
That got harder and harder. And part of the reason was that I guess when we went to summer cruises, we did away with this sort of dedicated license prep, where you had 6 weeks of 8 hours a day with the students getting ready for the license exam.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up with basically one semester, about 4 hours, four to 6 hours a week. So if you figure that out, we're talking about going from like 180 hours of license prep to like 40 hours of license prep. And so, as you would suspect, is that the license exam performance suffered.
Understandably.
Yeah. And that's been a problem for quite some time. We've had, I did a paper for the IMAU, I don't know if you know what that is. It's the International Association of Maritime Universities.
Okay.
And it's maritime universities. CMA is a member of the organization, but they're from all over the world. And every 2 years they get together someplace. 1 year they actually had a big conference here. But I did a paper in Alexandria, Virginia, because I was sort of concerned about, where are we going with the STCW issues, saying you got to have this many hours devoted to training on this subject and this subject and this subject for both deck and engine. The CSU requires that we have at least 120 hours or units worth of for the degree purposes,
mm-hmm.
of some of which has to be liberal arts and has to be this and math, and basically what we're getting to is that when I left, I think deckies had like 168 units. I mean, that's the bare bones curriculum. No electives. I mean, if you were interested in taking a literature course, you were on your own to figure out how to fit it in.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there was, you took the basic general studies courses to get your liberal educational aspects of the thing, but it wasn't a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the paper I wrote was, it's sort of like some of the things that we were required by the STCW to be teaching, I sort of questioned. And probably the one most students would recognize, is flashing light. I mean, why do we have to learn flashing light? It's not a big part of curriculum. It doesn't add a big load, but it's something that nobody uses. I question navigation, celestial navigation. To be honest with you, I like celestial navigation. I've really always enjoyed doing it. But, you know, most ships you go on, they're required by their classification society to have a sexton on board. Well, if you walk aboard, and I talked to a German officer, I talked to a Russian officer, you know, at this conference, and they said the same thing. You go aboard a ship and say, get me the sexton. They can't find it. Why? Because they never use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question was, you know, that's a lot of hours that we spend teaching students to do that. You know, and the question is, why? You know, if it's not, and the answer is because SDCW says you have to. And my question is, well, why don't we change it?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that sort of thing is not going to happen, you know, in the near future. I mean, there's been rumors around for 20 years that the Coast Guard is going to stop requiring flashing light. You know, and I always told the students that's wishful thinking. It's because they wouldn't like it to be that, not that there's any problem. And it's not going to happen in the near future. I think it will sooner or later. But what I was trying to raise in the university environment, not the regulatory environment, is that we need to start pushing on getting the workload done. Because, I mean, basically, both the deck and the engineering program here should be five-year programs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you just look at the number of units that are in them, it's a five-year program. So, I mean, those are things that, you know, need to be dealt with. They needed to be dealt with 15 years ago, but, you know, it's just the long, slow thing.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, I really enjoyed the licensed seminar classes. That was probably one of that, and I liked teaching rules of road. That was always just a very fun class,
mm-hmm.
because it involved a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, the interaction with the students.
Yeah. It wasn't just a dry lecture or, you know, class presentations, you know, I mean, the students that get all excited about making their class presentation, but it usually put me to sleep. You know, I just sit there, you know, get my attention here.
Yeah. Now, I'm sorry, what year was it that you had written that paper?
Had to be 2002, something.
2002?
Like that. Yeah. Yeah. Whenever the IMO was in Alexandria.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you had mentioned before that for your last year here at the Academy, you were the head of the MT department?
I was head of the MT department for a year, but I don't think it was the last year.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I got in a little Donnybrook with one of the presidents, and I basically just told him, I said, you know, if you can't trust me, then, you know, I can't really effectively be a department chair. So I said, well, I'll go back to being just one of the faculty members.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that also. I did what was called I'm trying to remember what the funny contractual name for it, but basically is that the last 2 years I was here, I didn't go on cruise.
Okay.
So, you know, you take a one quarter pay cut or something like that, because, you know, but it just got to the point where I just didn't want to go on cruise anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that much fun. But that's pretty much, you know, and to be honest with you, being a department chair is a hard, hard job.
Understandably.
Because as you probably have picked up, faculty can be obstinate sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
They get very set in their opinions. And so you have some, you know, that you're supposedly in charge of probably very intelligent, very opinionated, strong-willed people, and you're trying to get them to all go in the direction you want them to go. And that's not always easy. I think we used to have department meetings, and it was always somewhat of a joke, you know, is that we couldn't complete an agenda in an hour. I mean, we would take 20 minutes of work and make it into 3 hours. Because everybody had a different opinion and you couldn't move on until you got some consensus. And so it was an interesting job. I think Mark Sekelic probably was the most effective MT chair that we ever had, because he just didn't let it bother him that everybody didn't agree. He's, you know, he said, well, you don't have to agree. Nothing that says we all have to agree on this. So all I'm looking for is a majority.
Yeah. What year was he the department head?
Mark was probably department chair from like 2000 to maybe 2004 or 5. But then he passed away here like 2005, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he had pancreatic cancer. It was, that's a pretty quick moving cancer. It was mm-hmm. over from the time they diagnosed him until his funeral was very, very short.
That's terrible.
Yeah. And he was a fun, fun guy. He was for us from Kings Point.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you had mentioned this before, but while you were at CMA, what other ways did you see the Academy change?
Well, the biggest one probably was when we became part of CSU.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest way that that was impacted us was it stabilized our financial footing.
Mm-hmm.
That when Errol Rizzo was president, Errol Rizzo was a very unusual person. He was graduated from Pennsylvania Maritime, which, of course, doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Navy. I think he retired as a captain. And but he was president here for many, many years. In fact, Rizzo Auditorium is named for him.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't see him for days. And the reason was that he spent an inordinate amount of time in Sacramento, going from legislator's office to legislator's office to legislator's office, basically begging for the money to keep us operating for one more year.
Wow.
We were in the same category as the School of the Blind down
really?
In Berkeley. Yeah, we were a special school.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant our funding was in each year's budget, but there was no long, you couldn't plan long term. In other words, if you had a long term budget project, like the simulator, the engineering building, all of that stuff, the new res hall project, okay, all of that stuff was done after we became part of CSU. And the reason was, once we were part of CSU, then we had a budget for the year. And we also had next year's budget and the following year's budget. And we had also the access to long-term things, things that cost a lot of money, that you have to budget and take some money out of this year and some money out of the following year and following year. Well, that all of a sudden was available to us.
Okay.
And so it turned the president's job from being a fundraiser into a person who could get the money from the chancellor's office to do what he wanted to do. He became much more involved in the academic direction of the school. And so, I mean, those were big, big things. And I don't think the president's role in the academic directions, the expansion of the school, came about until the current president came. Okay, when Bill got here, we had sort of the all the workings in to make it work. Jerry Aspen came to us from, he's a CMA grad, but he came to us from being the CEO of Arco Marine. So he was running the Marine division of ARCO, and he came here. So his background was large corporate, money management, personnel management, because he basically was in charge of all the personnel and things like that. Mm-hmm. So he did very, very well in that. But the academic direction and, you know, where do we want to go? You know, issues like the library, issues like general studies. He relied heavily upon the provost or the academic deans to do it, and he sort of let them have fair run. Mm-hmm. Now, in between Abariza and Jerry, of course, we had Joe Eklund. Joe Eklund was probably the smartest person I ever met.
Really?
Brilliant, brilliant man. He was, interestingly enough, a submariner. And he had been the president of the Naval War College in Monterey.
Wow.
He basically lives in Monterey now. And I think he's still actively involved in the graduate school there in Monterey. But he basically came and got himself lined up, you know, fouled up in some sexual harassment issues, mm-hmm. that were, of course, none of his doing. I mean, the guy is the perfect gentleman. Mm-hmm. But things happened on cruise that became public knowledge that got out of hand. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of pressure. Jackie Speer, who's now a legislator in Washington, at the time was a legislator in the state in Sacramento, and she was from South Bay somewhere, I forget where. But anyway, she called a bunch of the women students down there, including one who later became a faculty member here. And she called these gals in and was personally grilling them on, did they feel that sexual harassment and inappropriate comments and inappropriate pinups and things like that, mm-hmm. were creating a hostile environment, you know, I mean, and basically these gals said no. And evidently she started cussing pretty hard.
Oh yeah.
And Betsy stood up and said, I don't have to listen to that kind of language. And I'm leaving. And she walked out.
And what year was this?
This had to be 90s. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the political pressure in the San Francisco Chronicle and everything else, and of course it would come out piecemeal. And evidently down in the lower holds there in number three hold on the old training ship, there was some equator crossing, shall we say, hijinks going on, mm-hmm. that a student had videotaped and then made the tape available to the local TV station, you know, some months later. And so it was just a very, very bad situation. And it was one of those things, you know, is that you don't know how to address the issue with the press. You don't know how to address the issue here internal. That we recognize that, hey, this can't go on. We're just going to stop. We're going to fix this. Mm-hmm. But how do you address it with the public, with the press, you know what I mean? Because they're just going to say all, you know, and as a necessity, Joe Eklund basically felt it for the good of the academy, and remember that this is before we became part of CSU, and he was just deathly afraid that the legislature, including Jackie Speer, mm-hmm. Were going to take it out on us by just chopping off the funds and shutting the place down. And that had come very close to happening back in Joe Riz's era. I mean, it was only his perseverance that kept his place open. So, I mean, it was a very real concern. So he said, for the good of the academy, I'm stepping down, and I'll leave as soon as we get the right person in here. And so we went out on a nationwide search, and I can remember Mr. Macko and I were on the faculty interview side of, you know, all the candidates, and we had probably, we hired a search company to sort of weed the chaff out, and so they gave us like four to look at. And after we were done with it, Mr. McMore and I were sitting there looking at each other, and I said, they all look the same. He said, I agree that they're all 50, they're all male, and they're all white. And so we said, this won't work. You know, we got to go out and open up the books again. So we found a female that came in, and her background was primarily administration and faculty in Catholic colleges. And she did excellent.
And what was her name?
What was her name? I'm drawing an old-timer's minute here. God, I can picture her, too. She had a young son that used to hang around the boathouse all the time.
Was it Mary Lyons?
Mary Lyons. There you go. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And her background, though, was pretty much academics.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she had some family connection in the military, like her father or something like that. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, I believe she was in the Navy.
Yeah, Naval Reserves.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But she did an excellent job. Is that she kept the legislator off our back.
Mm-hmm.
She instituted some changes here on campus that basically involved the faculty and the staff. We created things like what do we call them now? We used to call them commandants. What do they call them now? Ms. John, what's
it? Commandant.
Commandant, okay.
Yes, sir.
We've gone back to that name. For a long time they weren't. to basically be involved in the student's day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
We put employees up in the res hall to monitor what was going on there. The new traineeship actually helped out a lot in this harassment issues and bullying issues, too. To me, it was not just the harassment issues, but there was some bullying going on where upper class treated the lower class like some minions. And so there was a... By going to the new ship, you know, with this, instead of this big open bay berthing, is that we didn't have this thing. Is that if the roommates didn't get along, it was very easy to solve because it only involved one or two people.
Mm-hmm.
When that big open bay berthing, if there was a couple of people didn't get along, you had to start figuring out where you're going to move 50 people. Yeah, that was just, you know, so. And my last few cruises, you know, on the new training ship is that was never an issue. Mm-hmm. You know, people seem to get along a lot better than I remembered some of the... You know, part of it, too, is the living conditions. On the old training ship, we didn't have any air conditioning. So, I mean, it was always miserable, miserable living conditions.
Yeah.
So those are the big things I've seen. And then, of course, when Jerry left and the current president came, but Bill is like a breath of fresh air. He's a Naval Academy graduate, too.
Yes, sir.
But aviator. Two P3s. But that's all right. He's a smart, smart guy. And I had met him when he was the provost back at Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have conferences and... There was a conference back in Maine that I went to that he was intimately involved in, and I was very impressed with him. You know, Bill, I think, is very similar to some of the other presidents we had. He's very much an intellectual. He had hopes when he first came here, in fact he did, of having the president involved in teaching. And he taught a class for, I guess, 2 or 3 semesters. But then it got to be some political issues, like, you know, he's breaking the rice bowl with the faculty. You know, those teaching jobs are for the faculty.
What class was this?
He taught a leadership class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, if you had to take a leadership class, who would you like to see teaching it? I mean, the guy is a brilliant, brilliant guy. And it's interesting, the book he picked for the text was the book by the female basketball coach at Tennessee.
Really?
Yeah. Whose team had won, you know, like 7 or 8 national championships in a row. You know, and basically, and they say, well, what's that got to do with learning leaderships to apply in a shipboard environment?
Mm-hmm.
And that was really one of the questions that he hoped the course would answer for students, you know, is what can this lady tell me about how to learn to lead people? You know, I don't think he ever had more than like 10 people in the class. So, I mean, you know, if I was a student, to have a class taught by Bill, 10 people, God, you know, you'd jump at it to get in on that, yeah. So, you know, I think the biggest change, though, was the getting in with CSU, because it makes all these things possible. I mean, now I saw in the paper the other day that it looks like the new sports complex and the natatorium and, you know, the life-saving training facilities and things like that is a go. And, I mean, you know, we were trying to get that going, you know, back in 2000. You know, we've known for that long that we don't have the right facilities here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, that's kind of, you know, the type of thing that I've seen change. And I think going to the current traineeship was a big help.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have students do all the maintenance on the old traineeship, and I just got tired of it. You know, I mean, students on crews would spend at least 6 hours a day chipping and painting. You know, and my feeling was, after you've done it for a couple hours, our students are smart enough to figure out, okay, I now know how to chip and paint. Let me learn something new. Yeah. No, keep chipping and painting. And the reason was that we had to. We didn't have the money to have, you know, a contractor come in and do that. We were still a special school. We didn't have even marine paint. We used to use paint that we bought through the state purchasing agent. So we'd have Kelly Moore house paint, you know, but that's the paint we had. At least it was an oil-based paint.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just finally said, you know, I have other things that I could be doing with students during this time. So I conned Captain Kiever, and he came up with the money. I never figured out how. But we went to this new paint product that we had found called PRC. PRC stands for Product Research Corporation. And they were a small company. They've subsequently sold out to one of the major paint manufacturers. But you know the deck on the new training ship alongside the main deck there outside the Cal Poly Science Lab and everything, mm-hmm. sort of rough textured stuff?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's it.
Oh, okay.
And it's very expensive. You got to put down 2 coats of primer, a base coat, a non-skid coat, a top coat. And the base coat, you got like, I want to say 12 square foot a gallon.
Wow.
I mean, you know, this stuff didn't come, and it was like $75, $80 a gallon.
That's quite an investment.
Yeah, so basically what we'd do is we'd take a section each year, And I would get out there and we would take it down to bare metal and treat it and then start building it up. And we keep doing it and doing it and doing it. But the nice thing about it, once you get it down, is all you ever do is wash it. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, like every 2 years, it would sort of get a little dull looking. So what you do is you wash it up real good, and then just put on a coat of top coat, and it would be all nice and bright and shiny again.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the prep was not chipping. The prep was washing. And in fact, the old train ship is still sitting over at Mare Island. And if you go over there, you can see, you know, it's still got the PRC, and of course, nobody's done anything to that ship in maintenance in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the PRC still looks great. So we'd do a little bit each year so that, you know, chipping and painting became less of a necessity, and we ended up being able to find some time to do some meaningful training on cruise and also during ship ops. I mean, ship ops became a lot more fun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
All right.
I'd rather ramble that one, didn't I?
Now, as far as each of the presidents, going back to what we had
Richard, yeah.
Who did you believe had the greatest effect? I know you mentioned what each of them had done, but...
I think RZA.
RZA?
Yeah. You know, and it may be just distance pass makes things, you know, look a little bit different. You know, things sort of lose their sharpness. But he was a man of deep convictions that he wasn't going to see this school fail. And he had these very strong ideas about what should be happening and what people should be doing. And he personally made clear of it. I mean, Lou McDermott, Dr. McDermott is, I guess, an adjunct faculty here now. I sort of lost track of what his position here is. But at the time, he was a commandant.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the assistant commandant. And basically what would happen is we get a new commandant. Admiral Rizzo would fire the guy and make Lou the acting commandant. And then 6-7 months later, we'd hire a new commandant, and Lou would go back to assistant commandant. And I'd fire that guy. And so, you know, I finally said, why don't you just make him the commandant? You know? But Lou would have to step during morning formation. We used to have formation at 7:45 every morning out here in the compound area. And the president would stand in his office watching, see, and then he'd start yelling, Lou, get that guy. And it'd be some guy out there who, you know, shoes weren't shine, needed a haircut. But I mean, that was the detail. He expected our cadets to look sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And he was going to personally see that it was done. I mean, that was the type of thing that he did. When I first came here, the discipline system was a little bit different than what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had captain's mass, and we had sort of a little bit higher thing, the DRIC, and that's essentially the same. But we had a review board procedure where, you know, the student could appeal saying that they thought they were treated unfairly. And the review was, there was a pool, like four of us. And, you know, we just sort of went through in rotation. The next appeal is this person, the next appeal. And he used to call me in, you know, because he'd see the report from the conduct. He'd see the punishment of the judge. He'd read the appeal. He'd read my report. And he'd come in, he'd yell and scream, you know. And basically his position was that I was too lenient on the students. You know, a student would come in and tell me, gee, I'm sorry, and I'm not going to do that again. And I said, okay. And he just couldn't understand how I could accept on face value. He said, where's the tangible evidence that this guy has changed? And I'd say, well, called him. He told me he had changed. And but I mean that's the what I mean about Joe Rizzo,
mm-hmm.
is that he was driven to see that, you know, this school didn't fail, and that it would produce the high, and it didn't bother him to throw somebody out of school,
mm-hmm.
because he felt that if there's any question that this student will not be of the highest moral character, then I don't want him being associated with CMA. I don't want people to think that this is the kind of person we graduate. And so, let me tell you, if you tripped up once, that was it.
Now, did this happen on a regular basis?
No. But I mean, it was more of telling to me, it just told me who Joe Rizzo was,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, you know, I didn't have a lot to do with him. I didn't spend a lot of time with him. But, you know, he was a guy that I respected a lot, okay? And I really respect a lot Bill. I think that he has changed CMA. He's sort of kept the good things, and you know, he has some great ideas, and he evidently, you know, I don't know this because I never see him talk, but he evidently has the complete faith and confidence of the chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
I read in the paper and stuff like that, you know, where the chancellor's on some president at one of the other campuses or something like that, and it's, I mean, we're just a little tiny part of the CSU. If you look at our student population and everything else like that, and we get a disproportionate amount of support from the chancellor's office. And I got to believe it's because the chancellor has complete trust in Dr. Rathbun. He's, you know, if he says this is what the school needs, the chancellor says, you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, the school is not in danger of being closed. Where there was times in the past when that was true.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I say Rizzo's sort of probably the most influential president. But of the current ones, I think it's Bill. And you got to remember, too, is that Bill is coming up to being the longest tenured president since Rizzo. You know, I mean, it's kind of hard for me to accept that, you know, because I was involved with selecting them, you know, to come here, and it doesn't seem that long ago, but I don't know how many years he's got, but I know he's got more than Jerry. Jerry was here 5, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mary Lyons was here maybe 6, and I think Eklund was here like 3. So, you know, I mean, it's getting to the point where, you know, he's sort of, you know, and to most of the people here on campus now,
mm-hmm.
Bill's been here forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was here when they came, and hadn't he always been here? Because, you know, I walk around campus now, like, well, just a couple of weeks ago, I was down in the MT department faculty office areas, and there are a number of people down there that I don't know. There are a number of them that I do,
mm-hmm.
because for some reason, the MT faculty seems to be rather stable. Trying to think who would be the longest. I guess Buckley has been there the longest now. But, and then Stewart's back. He was in business for many, many years. Would be the next longest, I guess. Lida. Sarheim. Bill Schmidt,
mm-hmm.
Peter Hayes came from Texas, what, 4 years ago? 5 years ago, 5 years ago, maybe. So, I mean, you know, one of the newest guys has been here like 5 years. So, you know, that's one of the things that I think is kind of cool about the place is that people are very happy being here. And they come and they stay. There's very few that, you know, come and last 6 months and then leave because it's not what they thought. And it's not, we took a pay raise when we went to CSU, but it wasn't as much as people think. And the reason was that the CSU put a cap. It was not going to be a windfall. That our faculty wasn't all of a sudden going to be making the same as a faculty at Cal Poly or something like that. But you know, when I first came here, they didn't pay very much. Back in 1979, I think my starting salary was like $1,800 a month. And that, the only reason I could afford to come here is I had my retirement from the Navy. So between the two of them, it wasn't a great retirement from the Navy either. But between the two of them, you know, it made a reasonable salary that I could do something I wanted to do. Because to be quite honest, when I got out of the Navy, I was going to go work for Bechtel. And then I just said, you know, it paid quite a bit of money, but would have meant commuting to San Francisco, and that didn't particularly turn me on. And it would have meant maybe 6 months out of the year, you're out of the country. And I just said, that sounds too much like being in the Navy. You know, so I said, no, I don't think so.
And at this time, you were living in Benicia?
No, we were, well, I was still, you know, job hunting, so I was living in Virginia. And I came out and went around to various places. My brother is the proverbial rocket scientist. You know, the old thing, you know, it's not rocket science, you know. Well, my brother was a rocket scientist for Aerojet. And so, you know, I know him. And so I know that rocket science can't be very hard. Not that, I'm just teasing my brother. But, so I'd stay up at his place, and then I'd go around, you know, various places, job interviewing, looking for a job. And I came down here primarily because it was a teaching job, and it was something that I felt, you know, was within my background. And it was an academy at the time. You know, I mean, it was uniforms. I mean, and you wore uniforms all the time. And so that was kind of fun. And they did have the opening in the tech department. To be quite honest with you, if they had an opening in the engineering department, I would have put in for it too. And that was kind of fun because as a dually, is that I used to teach occasionally engineering courses. The problem that you'd have, and this is back years ago, but if a student got an F in a course, there was no provisions for them to repeat the course the following year. Basically, you had to go back and do the whole year over again, including the courses you passed. And so what would happen would be some courses, let's say dynamics, that had a history of getting to a number of students. It was not uncommon to have, you know, five or six fail the course. And so basically what I would, they would, and they didn't have the faculty. In other words, faculty could only teach X number of courses. You assigned a faculty to teach the courses for this term, and there wasn't any faculty to teach an additional repeat of dynamics. So what they do is they get me to come over and teach dynamics or teach they were very careful about what courses they'd let me teach. It was basically the ones they didn't want to teach. Like, there's a course called Engineering for Deckies.
Mm-hmm.
They basically teach deck students enough engineering so that when the phone rings in the middle of the night, they can carry on a somewhat meaningful conversation. And that was, it was an engineering department course, and an engineering department course number taught by engineering faculty. But again, when they'd get into a problem, like, you know, if an engineering faculty member wanted to go on sabbatical
mm-hmm.
for 6 months, they didn't have enough faculty then to allow that faculty member to go on sabbatical and teach the courses. And so they'd say, Dave, could you teach this engineering course for us? And of course, it's all deck students sitting in there. So that was kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it helpful, too, on crews sometimes, you know, where you have to have a, quote, licensed engineer observe something like lighting off the steering gear or something. And if we were having problems in the engine room and we're getting underway in an hour, it was just as easy for me to go back, put on an engineering hat, if you will, soup and light off the steering gear and test the steering gear and let the engineers take care of the real problem
mm-hmm.
that they had. Because it really didn't take that, but technically it had to be an engineer. So having a licensed engineer in the deck department was sometimes helpful.
Now, were there many faculty members at this time that had both licenses?
No, none.
So
I was the only one. And it was kind of one of these things. I was going to grad school at Berkeley at the time. And I just got my master's license from Third Mates. And we're coming up to having an accreditation visit. And I asked John Kiever, I said, you know, I know these guys are big on paper. I says, I'm not going to have my grad work done before they come. Would it help if I also had an engineering license? I mean, would that be just another piece of paper? It says, I don't know, probably. So I said, well, okay, let me check with the Coast Guard and see what I got to do. And so the Coast Guard went through all my stuff and said, well, we'll let you sit for second assistant. And I said, okay. And so it was really not to get the engineering license. It was just something that I was trying to do to make the, you know, fluff up the faculty and not us, make us look like a bunch of pipe fitters, you know, that don't know anything about academics.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you get a license, it's fairly easy to renew it. But it also convinced me, to be quite honest with you, that dualies are not a good idea.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I think that basically, it's literally impossible to stay current in both sides of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is you sail predominantly on your engineering license or predominantly on your deck license, and your skills in the opposite license slowly deteriorate
mm-hmm.
to the point where, you know, I'm not convinced that you're, you know, even as good as, you know, a fresh out of the school graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't see the need for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see where it's not like pilotage, you know, where if a ship's captain has pilotage, he can save the ship a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Having an officer that's dual license, I don't see where that helps the ship. And of course, does he now have to join both unions?
Oh, yeah.
To sail on both licenses? And so, you know, I wouldn't encourage anybody. I think Betsy McNee was probably our last dualie.
And
she graduated probably 85.
From here?
Yeah, 85, okay. 90, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. She came back as a faculty member, but. And then she went on to, she wanted to go off to grad school, and so she took off for grad school. But, you know, sharp gal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, probably the funniest one, you know, the thing that just from a personal side, ever happened to me is, I guess I was, it had to be like 84 or something like that. And it's the first day of the fall term, and I'm teaching freshman seamanship. You know, the basic seamanship, you know, the classroom one.
Yep.
And I'm taking roll, you know, and butchering everybody's name. I come down to his name, and I said, "Oh, Debbie Jinks." His voice says, "Here." And I looked at her, and I said, "How's your shoulder?" She looked at me kind of funny. I said, "Didn't you fall out of that cherry tree in Ledger, break your shoulder?" She says, "Yeah." I said, "Well, my oldest son fell out of that same cherry tree the next year and broke his shoulder." But what it was is her father was Shep Jinks, who was very famous. He's almost as famous as Joe Eklund. Joe Eklund, you know, I mean, if you talk to submarine, you say Eklund, they say range, okay, because he's kind of famous for developing a mathematical method of determining the range passively to something, where you don't, you know, you don't send out echoes or anything like that. But her dad, Shep Jinks, was a very famous submariner, and he owned a like 200-year-old farmhouse in Ledger. And when he left submarines to leave Ledger area, he sold the house to me. And so we lived in the same, you know, house, literally, not at the same time. And his daughter, you know, I knew her. She was, shall we say, very firm in her beliefs. And she, I can remember when she was like 12, and she wanted to become an altar boy at church. And I was sort of running the training and scheduling of the altar boys. And so she came to me and said, "I want to be an altar boy." And I said, "Well, Debbie, what part of boy don't you understand?" And she said, "Well, that's not right." And so I said, "Well, let's see what we can do." And let me tell you, it took about 5 months. We changed the name to Acolyte and had to go all the way to the bishop and all this other stuff. But boy, she wouldn't let it go. And she became the first female altar boy in the whole Diocese of Connecticut. But that shows you what kind of gal she was. And she ended up being the core chief mate. She sailed for years as captain in Chevron, married a classmate who was an engineer, and they live up in Nevada now, and I see him every once in a while because her father, Shep, now lives in Benicia.
Wow.
So he's one of my once-a-month breakfast guys. We get together for breakfast. About eight of us that get together and have breakfast once a month. But that was just, you know, one of the epitomes of small worlds. The other one was, I was down in the boathouse when I was chief mate, and the door opens and in walks this, you know, turns out to be a brand new student, freshman. Mm-hmm. And he probably, you know, 18 years old. And I looked at him and I said, "Hey, Bill." And he says, "How'd you know my name?" I says, "Because I knew you." It turns out really what I knew is his father. Mm-hmm. And this kid is a spitting image of his father. And I'd known his father in the Navy. And his father was a nuclear submariner too. So, you know, I didn't even know that this kid was coming. He didn't know I thought here. He just walked in looking around. He was looking for Mr. Gephardt. I don't know if you ever heard stories about Gephardt.
I haven't heard any stories. I've heard the name before.
Yeah, Gephardt was a retired Navy chief petty officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of was, the, ran the boathouse, taught all the small boat classes, maintained them. Yeah.
In 5 minutes.
Okay, yeah. But he was the guy you went and saw when you were in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, somebody had a big DRIC issue or something.
Mm-hmm.
As he either went and saw Gephardt, or right next to him, the guy you saw was Bob Ferguson. But Cletus Gephardt was sort of a deckie. Bob Ferguson was one of the engineering ratings on a ship. And he was, at one time, had been a priest. Or, I guess not a priest, but he'd been a monk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so he was really kind of a funny guy. But the two of them knew how to manipulate the CMA legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was a loophole to get you out of trouble, they knew how to do it. And so they were sort of like, if you're in trouble, you go hire F. Lee Bailey, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, at CMA, you went and saw these two guys. And they were real characters, but they were around for a long time.
All right. Now, just to kind of wrap it up, what have you been up to since retiring?
Well, I work 2 days a week with the Benicia Police Department, and basically doing volunteer work. And it's primarily doing courier work and going around, and when people are on vacation, I go rattle their doors and make sure that, you know, nothing's out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Do traffic control and, you know, tag vehicles for towing who have, you know, parked in the street with expired tags. But it's it's sort of fun. And then you do a lot of the computer work. So when a patrol officer calls in with a name, you know, the fact that the person had been arrested last week has a chance of being in the computer,
yeah,
and they'll know about it. So that's, I do that. And then I do some consulting, primarily admiralty law.
Okay.
There's a very good friend of mine who's a famous admiralty law instructor, is a lawyer. And he and I wrote a couple of books on admiralty law. And he is the retainer lawyer for the pilot on this Costco Busan. So the next day he was calling me and saying, can you come aboard and help on this? Because John Meadows, the lawyer, is like 85 now, and he's, you know, climbing up ladders and going around looking at things. It's not his forte.
Uh-huh.
So he says, I need somebody younger. And I said, well, 71 ain't a lot younger. Okay.
All right, well,
but
thank
that,
you.
That keeps me out of bars.
Good deal. All right, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
I appreciate your time and
yeah,
sharing all that with us.
Okay, Justin, thank you.
Thank you.
Dominic, thank you.
Thank you.